Hello and welcome to Heresy, the show that fights against received opinion. For example, the world thinks, say what you like about Frankie Boyle, but you wouldn't want him playing Santa Claus at a children's party. But we say, nonsense! Forever after, your children will be so terrified of celebrating Christmas that you'll save a fortune on presents. Make Santa stop talking, Mummy. Christmas is coming and we've got a festive lineup of guests. Please welcome Professor Germaine Greer, Dr. Phil Hammond, and the completely unqualified Rufus Hound. We'll be covering a specific Yuletide topic later on, but first, let's have a bit of Elvis.
Well, bless my soul, but what's wrong with me? I'm itching like a man on a fuzzy tree. My friends say I'm acting wild as a bug. I'm in love. I'm all shook up.
Itching, white as a bug, you're in love. Or you've got Lyme disease. 75% of our live audience tonight believe you should not self-diagnose using the internet. Phil Hammond, you're a doctor. Is the internet a helpful diagnostic tool?
It's a wonderful thing. I think we should go the whole hog. Just leave a great big trough of drugs outside my door and say, help yourself. Make your own diagnosis, help yourself with the tablets, leave me alone. Fantastic. We're supposed to put patients at the centre of the NHS, which shouldn't mean the middle drawer of the mortuary, but... They've done research on this. They've shown that if you go to Dr. Google or his friend Professor Wikipedia, you have a 58% chance of getting it right. Doctors marginally ahead at about 75%. So you can have a good guess. You need a slightly robust constitution. You need to have an elementary understanding of risk, because every headache ultimately ends up as a brain tumour or a hemorrhage. But the nice thing is that then we can reassure patients. It's a happy thing. And we only have 10 minutes a patient. By the time the double buggies come in and out, that's about 6 minutes. So if you come with your diagnosis already, we can then move on to the, you know, the therapeutic gossip and the hand-holding and the hand-washing and the other things we're supposed to do as a doctor. So it's great. It, you know, it's the elephant in the room to diagnosis. Get it out of the way. Have a gossip. Play a game of drafts. Off you go. I'm all in favour. Fantastic idea.
Although sometimes it's the elephant Titus in the room.
Hey!
Do you, Germaine Greer, do you ever do this, self-diagnose?
Well, I don't think there's anything else to be done. I went to university with some very stupid people who all turned out to be doctors in the end. And the way they deal with you is you come in with a fairly obvious set of symptoms and they just give you the thing they've been giving to everybody else. If it works, it was a good diagnosis. If it doesn't work, you come back again. And you said 10 minutes there, Phil. It's 2. Where do you live? You said 10 minutes. The thing about it is you don't do it with Google or Wikipedia. Here is a hint. You can subscribe to Medline. All you have to do is put doctor in front of your name. And they won't even check up. And then you can really study your disease. Now, I'm quite serious about this because... I think doctors can't do it anymore. They take responsibility for the treatments we get so that when they don't work, everybody bitches and screams and cries malpractice. Ultimately, you have to decide what is done with your body and you have to take responsibility.
You sue yourself if you get it wrong.
Don't sue anybody if you get it wrong. Die. Just... do the decent thing. Die. The planet needs you to die.
Happy as I am to kick off our Christmas special with Germaine Greer shouting, die, all of you die. The internet itself, of course, some people say causes medical problems like eye strain and neck pain and for some young men apparently a sort of wrist ache. Rufus Hound, do you think you overuse the internet? Might you make yourself ill?
I use it the exact right amount. and that is almost all of the time. Because everybody's smarter than I am. I'm an idiot. So if I'm trying to find something, you ask a large group of people, you reach some sort of consensus.
Germaine, do you not think that one of the reasons people say don't self-diagnose is because doctors don't like to see their priesthood dissolved with the democratising of knowledge?
Well, this is the story of medicine in the Western world, that people treated themselves. They used remedies that were commonly available. They either worked or didn't work, pretty much like now.
yeah, but in fairness, more of them didn't work than did.
The interesting thing is that doctors use search engines too. It's quite common for doctors to use Google. If you look at their computer screen, you'll actually see them typing. I had a mate who's a pain specialist on the south coast somewhere, and he was teaching a junior doctor, and a woman came in with Wartenberg's neuritis, and he was looking at the notes before she came, and he said to his junior doctor, "Look, I've never heard of this. Let's look it up on Wikipedia." They look it up, they make the notes, and this woman walks in and says, "I'm terribly sorry. I was standing outside. I heard you say to your junior doctor you'd never heard of Wartenberg's neuritis. You were going to look it up on Wikipedia. I thought I ought to warn you, I'm the person who wrote the entry on Wikipedia." That's how it works, man. And if you've got a smartphone, you can find out during a consultation whether the doctor treating you is treating you according to the best guidelines from the National Institute of Health and Clinical Excellence, whether he's doing the right thing. It has the potential, if you use it properly, to completely revolutionise the doctor-patient relationship. I think it's a great thing. The flip side of that is if you take more decisions for yourself rather than letting the doctor take them for you, as Jermaine says, the buck passes on to you when things go a bit tits up.
But isn't that the inevitability of living in a health and safety society where doctors are so terrified of being sued for malpractice or misdiagnosis that what I think people really love about self-diagnosis is that when I Google something, I am absolutely certain that I've got lung cancer. Whereas when they say there's just a reasonable chance it might be bronchiolitis, I'm like, well, you're only wishy-washy about
it,
whereas
The thing you have to understand is no diagnosis is definite. It always starts off as a probability. It's probably a virus is the GP equivalent of Mornington Crescent. There is always a number of diagnoses in the early stage, and cancer is one of them, and brain hemorrhage is one of them, and if you understand probability, you'll know how likely it is and when to come back if it's not getting better.
Ah, but that's a big thing to say, because human beings don't understand probability. But there's another aspect I'd like to put here.
Well, hang on,
which
I think
is
about four-fifths of them do.
No, they bloody don't, or they wouldn't.
There are three types of human beings. Those who understand probability and those who don't.
Hang on a minute. If people understood probability, they wouldn't buy lottery tickets, would they?
They wouldn't go to doctors either.
No, right.
We are at this point going to ask the audience for an opinion. Lucy Baker, you think people should not self-diagnose using the internet. Why not?
Well, there are far too many hypochondriacs in the world as it is. And, like, you talk about people being able to self-diagnose and, like, know what's good for them. But you look at just London, for example, we're talking about the same people that voted in Boris Johnson as London mayor.
But what makes you think that doctors are always going to get it right if the people they treat are idiots? Why are doctors special? They're just people that did medical degrees, no disrespect, Bill.
Well, I don't think they always get it right. I think sometimes they do get it wrong, and I think that...
What? 15% of diagnoses are wrong first time, 15%.
Only 15%.
Oh, that's just me. I don't know about anyone else.
That sounds like a hell of a chat-up line.
The point is, you don't have to make a diagnosis. You have to know the red flags. If you're losing weight, you have lumps and bumps somewhere, if you can't move part of your body, etc., there are certain things that you don't know the diagnosis of that you know are bad news. And weight loss, lumps and bumps, and blood from any orifice, difficulty breathing, chest pain, are red flags. You get help immediately. You don't know what the diagnosis is, but you know if you don't do, you will die.
And a happy Christmas to you.
Thank you.
Louise Meeson, why do you think patients should not self-diagnose on the internet?
There's a lot to be said for kind of positive thinking when you're feeling ill.
Well, I'm positive, you know, I've got a brain tumour.
I think you can do a little bit of research, but I think things can go too far when people start looking and researching so much, they convince themselves that they're ill.
Now, what do you think, Professor? Is there such a thing as research going too far?
Hey, quiet, this bird's trying to speak.
The memorial service for Rufus Howe.
Research goes too far when it goes off the track and goes up a blind alley.
Ned Gibson, why shouldn't people self-diagnose online?
I think it leads to sort of hysteria and works people up into thinking all these terrible things, and they should just leave it to the people who have read more articles, Wikipedia or not.
You can take a photo with your smartphone, send it off to an online dermatologist who'll give you a diagnosis in seconds. DermNet NZ is a New Zealand-based dermatologist. It's got every picture of skin rashes you could ever hope to see. If you've got a skin rash, just flick through that, see if you've got one that spots. It's like playing snap, ding, 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 snap, ding, 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 snap, and it'll do your diagnosis.
You like the sound of that? Ned, would you go on there?
I've been on there, actually, yeah.
Have you?
It's not a dating site. Psoriasis, she's a foxy beast.
Let's leave that there with a final cheer for internet self-diagnosis over doctor's appointments. I do worry about going to the doctor. Sometimes I wonder if I'm standing there with my top off being examined only because the man is wearing a white coat and has a kindly manner and his ice cream van plays such a jolly tune. Let's head back now to a time before the internet. Sound happy, even though they're singing about misery. Perhaps it's because of music like this that 65% of our live audience believe the 60s were a great time to be young. The concept of teenage had just been invented. It was all free love, untainted drugs and radical politics. Rock and roll was born and lived happily for many years until it was hunted down and killed by Jedward. Jermaine Greer, were the 1960s just an idyll for the young?
I think people don't remember how difficult it was for the counterculture in the 60s. We were hunted down. Our property was taken by the police. We were stopped and searched in the street. I can remember once getting off a bus at Marble Arch, and the police came up and said, excuse me, there's a stop and search. Can you turn out your pockets, please? And we said, why have we got to turn out? They said, because two men answering your description have been reported. We said, two men? It was crazy. And we had a tough time working out what to do about contraception. We also had a rather undeveloped approach towards sexually transmitted infections of a trivial kind, like there was a disease known as non-specific urethritis.
Still there.
Except it's now... it's now called chlamydia, for the most part, because we actually figured out that there was an organism involved. All you have to do to find that out, by the way, is to do a bit of research. But no one was doing it. So
it wasn't a multiple organism, by any chance.
What?
There's no such thing.
As a multiple organism.
How was, Phil Hammond, how were the 1960s for you?
Well, I was brought up in Australia, so I was living in Perth, the most isolated state capital in the world, and I was brought up on Rolf Harris. Boy, it was fun. Carra Barra Wurra Canna, a little late with lovely name. The ladies of the harem of the Quarter King Correcticus, remember that? My problem with the 60s generally is that the secret of a happy adolescence is learning how to pleasure yourself in a safe and sustainable
but
way.
But Rolf tried to help you.
What?
He What do you think Rolf was talking about when he talked about two little boys and two little toys?
Yeah, but
how
it was Jake the Pig. It was Jake the Pig with his third leg.
Whoa,
I was
whoa,
on
whoa! At what point do you have to tie your kangaroo down?
After
the ladies of the harem of the Quarter King Correcticus have walked by.
I'm going to throw in again. This is Radio 4 and it's our Christmas show. Phil Hammond, how were the 1960s for you?
I think the secret of a happy adolescence is learning how to pleasure yourself in a safe and sustainable way. And my problem with the 1960s is that people over-pleasured.
Rufus Hound, you weren't born in the 1960s. Do you wish you had been?
After hearing these two, not really. I think that it doesn't really matter what era you are young in, because you are young. And all of the experimentation and all of the, you know, the thrill of the first times of everything. There is no better time than any other to be a young person, I would have thought.
Well, you must have had a happier adolescence than I did. What I think is, I enjoyed being a little kid. I enjoyed being an adult. I hated the middle bit, where there was all this pressure to take drugs and have sex and all this stuff that terrified me. And I'd have been happy in about 1940 when that bit didn't exist.
But imagine that. Imagine that and having to listen to Jefferson Airplane at the same time. How bad can it get?
Don't you think that, though, Jermaine? The 60s were the start of the terrible pressure on teenagers to be cool.
I think teenagers will always put pressure on themselves to be cool. The important thing to remember about the 60s is that it was born... The whole movement was born out of the war in Vietnam. I mean, I used to demonstrate in London with Australians Against the Vietnam War, and there's some very interesting video where you can't tell who I am, but it's me, because I recognise my coat.
Who's that young man?
With the upturned pockets.
But we were really serious, you know, and we took a lot of punishment. My godson, Ben, who is a rock and roll musician now, says to me, "Did you really know Jimi Hendrix?" And I want to say, did anybody really know?
No, but did you really know Jimi Hendrix?
I did.
What was he like?
The thing that's most amazing about Jimmy is he was so bright. He had the fastest mind, and he was so vulnerable. He was always going to be shot down, one way or the other.
I do want to put in an interesting statistic here. 65% of our audience agree the 60s were a great time to be young, but only 30% of our audience were alive in the 60s. So that means, Rufus, that, like you and me, from a different generation, sold this as an ideal youth
team. Well, I think that's it, isn't it? We see the posters of Quadrophenia, we see the posters of Woodstock, we see the footage of the Beatles, and we just assume that at the time those legends were being written, it must have been magical. But I think the truth is, there was such a rarefied few who were really living that kind of swinging 60s lifestyle that actually, for the vast majority, it was just as tedious and dull as it had been in the sort of late 40s through the 50s.
The real difference is that we thought the revolution was coming. We thought that capitalism was dead. We thought that all we had to do was think of new lifestyles, new ways of relating, and there would be a future that was free and relaxed, that wouldn't need to trample on the faces of the poor. We really thought that it was just around the corner, and that turned out to be completely wrong. And that's been very hard for us, survivors of that era, to live with.
But is it not also the case that many of the people who had those ideals have then gone on to be the most capitalist?
You're talking about Felix Dennis.
I'm talking about Ben and Jerry.
We're going to go to audience now. Mary Lawrence Pace, you were alive in the 1960s. You've written ish. What does that mean?
It was me. It means I was born in 1963.
Oh, not that you were on so many drugs that you can't remember.
No, no. No. My influence was still the 60s, very much, with the hope and the ideal of it.
But do you not think that teenagers today, with their access to the internet so they can make friends more easily, there's a whole culture for young people, do you not think they're as happy as people were in the 60s when they had to create their own?
Yes and no, because the access that you get from the internet also tells you about all the things going on in Syria and, you know, the Amazon being destroyed and so on, so they also have more access to the bad news.
If you want to know how teenagers are using the internet to make themselves happy, rest assured there isn't a teenage boy in the UK that's reading about Syria.
Where is Jamie Scowen? Jamie Scowen, you weren't born in the 1960s, but you wish you had been a teenager then. Why?
Well, it's what my mum tells me, you know. When you sit on TV and you think, well, hold on, you've got all these parties going on, everyone's happy and jolly, that just looks good, and people's attitudes were different. You know, people seem friendlier then.
Do you not feel, Jamie, that it's just because the people you see in the footage are the ones who are out at parties? You see, I imagine that the vast majority of people in the 60s were sort of sobbing in a cafe over an unwanted pregnancy or having a fight on the beach with a bicycle chain. Do you not think... You look at all these images of people
That's
partying.
His mum you're talking about.
No, no disrespect to your mother, but...
Although you should have seen her wield that bicycle chain.
Do you look at this footage and believe that was everyone having fun?
Well, the thing is, my mum was saying that not everyone had drugs, because everyone's thinking now, you know, that was the norm for every teenager. And she says that's not true, but that's probably just her. But my biggest thing about the 60s is one thing she told me was that when she used to get on buses, she used to wear the shortest of miniskirts, which is the norm in those days. And the guys would be like real gentlemen, right? And they would let them go up first. And that's... and that's the biggest thing in my mind, you know what I mean? But obviously not with my mum. Because that would just be wrong.
Time to wind up our chat about the 60s. And we're back in the present. Bye-bye, disappointing 1960s. For our next topic, you know what's coming, only 4 days away. So here it is, Merry Christmas, everybody's Except it hasn't just begun, has it? It's been going on since August. But now's the time to get properly excited. Have you done all your shopping? Or perhaps you haven't done any. 38% of our audience believe the best Christmas presents are the ones you make yourself. I can see a case for that. Shopping can get very expensive. Last year in my family, we agreed to set a limit of £20 on each person's present. But you know how it is. I ended up ignoring that completely and spending around £1.50. Rufus Hound, should I be making presents?
No. No, you should not. This is a lie spread by the poor. There is not a child... Look, Christmas is a time for children, and children want toys and stuff, and that stuff needs to be bigger, more expensive and flashier than all of their friends. Christmas is about getting expensive electrical items that you can plug into your television set and ignore the rest of your family. If you've woven your son or daughter something that you believe they're going to open this Christmas and be more delighted with than they would a PS3, you're an idiot.
I don't know what you're supposed to make. I imagine myself on Christmas morning going, I made you this, it's a sort of toaster.
Well, this explains why you're so confused. If you think even a normal toaster is an acceptable Christmas gift.
Phil Hammond, have you ever made anyone a present?
I have. Interesting boys have interesting hobbies. I used to polish rocks. I had a little rock tumbler. And I used to make all my relatives, male and female, little cufflinks or little... I'd get a stainless steel mounting and I'd lump a big bit of tiger's eye on there with a bit of araldite, stick it on there. And bless my Auntie Pauline, she'd always wear it. That's the awful thing about giving somebody a present that doesn't dissolve or you don't eat, is that every time you come around for the next 15 years, they've got to ferret around with that awful bit of tiger's eye on the stainless steel mounting and stick it on the finger. And Auntie Pauline would put it on every year.
My little sister used to always make us presents, and she would wrap up the thing she liked the best, a stone, a bead, or something, and then she would give it to you and say, this is a present. And you'd say, oh, just the bead I've been looking for. What a clever little girl. Thank you so much. But then you might forget and leave the bead somewhere, and she'd appear and say, this is the bead I gave you, and I found it. The whole thing is calculated to make people insane. I'm not doing it. No presents this year. What's not to like about a recession?
Ah, the George Osborne School of Christmas.
But it is, I think the recession is key, because don't you think, Rufus, I suspect a conspiracy. There's a recession, nobody's got any money, nobody can spend anything, and as if by magic, it crops up, oh, there's a new fashion. Home baking, knitting, making things, programmes like the Great British Bake Off. I feel like we're being tricked into thinking we want stuff that doesn't cost any money to hide the fact that we haven't got any.
Look, fundamentally, you can always buy something. I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad tidings, but we are no longer citizens, we're consumers. It's our job to have things from shops.
If you've
baked something and you tip up at my house on Christmas Day going, oh, Merry... I'm gonna ask you to leave. Because you have not understood the brief. The brief is bring me something that I've seen advertised on television.
The other point is that homemade presents aren't necessarily cheap. And so many people, they'll make their quince jelly or something, and the first three batches, they'll be pissed, so it'll all fall on the floor. And by the time you've bought all the ingredients four times round, it's not necessarily cheaper. And the thing that happens to all the quince jelly and all the chutney, I can tell you this now, is that people don't want it, they give it to their GP. I love you, doctor. You're the only doctor in the establishment. And then... the GPs don't want it either, so they give it to the receptionist, which is why the receptionists are so grumpy.
Let's go to the audience. Jason Maud, you think the best Christmas presents are the ones you make yourself. Give me an example.
Lego.
No.
More from a shop.
No, I had my own plastics factory.
Lego doesn't count because you need to be bought the box.
There are countless stories of kids who get given a really expensive gift and they look at it for a bit, put it down and then go, oh, a box, and then they start playing with the box.
Right, but unless you are a Chinese child, you didn't make the box.
It's
So you're saying that the only presents you can count as making yourselves are the ones that you've gone out and harvested the natural resources.
I'm saying that the only presents that count that you made yourself are the ones that Kirsty Allsop fawned over to an old pensioner somewhere in Norfolk who was stood next to a furnace who probably smelt of nettles and despair.
Seriously, Jason, how old are you?
I am 28.
Are you going to be making your Christmas presents this year out of Lego?
Not all of them.
Are you single, Jason?
Yes.
Diane Gatrea, you've confused me. The best Christmas presents are the ones you make yourself. You've ticked agree and disagree. What does that mean?
Well, I think if one of my grandchildren made me a gift, it's very sweet, and you treasure it forever and you keep it forever. If your husband did it, you wouldn't want it. So, it was a bit of a grey area.
Can you please pass the microphone to your husband for a moment? Are you now feeling crushed as you remember the lovely homemade ashtray or chutney that you had tucked under the tree?
The only thing I make well are mistakes.
Hang on. Let's turn this around. What was your name, sir?
Stephen,
right. We're going to give Stephen a moment of genuine Christmas joy, OK? We're going to ask Stephen that question again. Stephen, I want you to give the answer. The only thing I make well is love. It's Christmas! Let's ask him again.
Are you planning to make Christmas presents this year?
Yes.
And what are you going to make?
Love.
So it's time to wrap up in every sense of the word. We'll be back next week after the huge family row. Sorry, the festivities. Have a nice Christmas. If you don't see Santa Claus, don't worry, he is there. It's just that everyone leaves a glass of whiskey out for him, so he's asleep on the back seat of his sleigh after five houses. Thanks very much to my guests, Phil Hammond, Rufus Hound and Germaine Greer. Good night.